This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to number two in the Wheeler Centre's Africa Talk series on Africa's Not a Country tonight. And how, so we're going to be looking at how the Australian media reports on Africa and the African community. And to help me flesh all of that out, I've got people that actually work in the industry, which is great. So beginning right at the end is Stanny Gomer. And Stanny is the presenter and producer of Flight 1067 to Africa. It's a radio show on PBS that airs every Sunday between 3 and 5 p.m. The program features music from all over the African continent and takes the listener on a musical journey around the African continent. Sitting next to Stanny is Ginny Stein. She is a reporter and producer and camera operator. She's spent much of her career working as a foreign correspondent, most recently in Africa for the ABC, and she films her own stories. And next to Ginny is Bertrand Tundangame, and Bertrand has worked as a journalist in print media in Belgium and Rwanda, covering events in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa, and he currently works for SBS, just like me. Please make them feel welcome. So Africa is not a country. Huge topic. I guess my first question is, why do you think there is this tendency to describe Africa as more as a continent, as a country, and less of seeing it as individual states? Who would like to take that one on?
One word: ignorance. Yeah. I suppose I think certainly, you know, times have changed with the internet. People have the opportunity to find out more about the continent. But I think there were times when Africa, you know, back in the, you know, what was it? What was the expression? Deep dark.
Days.
Where Africa was just regarded as this one place where people lived in the jungle and there was nothing there. So I think some of that's still with us. But it is changing. It is changing. It's quite interesting because I do a program that covers the music of Africa. And one of the challenges that I find is to try and, you know, provide or play music that is representative of the entire continent, 54 countries. And very often I have people asking me questions about, well, that is not African music. And so there is a lot of ignorance out there. There's a lot of... and the one thing that I don't know, because I didn't go to school here, one of the questions that I have for people that sort of grew up here and went to school here, how much do you learn about Africa at school? I suspect not a great deal. So in my mind, that's probably the part of the answer, is that people don't actually learn about it at school.
I must admit, when I first went, when I first heard the phrase, which, you know, you laugh about, I didn't realise how entrenched it is until I actually got to Africa as a correspondent and started trying to report from there. And the amount of times I actually have been asked by other journalists that one question, oh, things are bad in Africa, aren't they? When do you think there will ever be an improvement in Africa? And I'm going, well, it's a bit like saying, oh, things are bad in Europe. How, you know, and when you even say, you start talking about Europe, you're thinking about, oh, back into the days before the First World War. I mean, it's kind of that thing. I look at it too as, like, people used to refer to Asia as, you know, Asia, and they couldn't break it down. There was a generation where ignorance was such that it was like that. Maybe it was Asia and Japan, but that's about as far as it went. It does take a lot of time for people to understand it. Ignorance, absolutely. We're that far removed from there, possibly, that our zone of influence and isn't as great, or it's not as great here. But it's there, and it's very much a reality.
Yeah, and having covered Africa and African stories from different perspectives, different continents, different parts of the world, what I can say that is missing in the African narrative is the input of Africans themselves in the narrative. If you're talking, let's say, about the Great Lakes region, you're in Rwanda or Burundi or Congo or anywhere in the area, if you're going to report on a story about Rwanda and you're based in Rwanda, that's fine, you're local. But talking about the Congo or any other country surrounding that Rwanda, you don't have enough resources to cover those stories as well. The only resources that you get are from international media, international news agencies. So that's already a lack. And then when you come to Australia, we have the same thing happening. The narrative about Africa is not told by Africans. It's told through the lens of Western media organizations and Western journalists. A lot of them are not as lucky as Ginny, who's been there. A lot of them will cover from here, and they rely on news reports, news provided by news agencies. And these news agencies, sometimes, they might not have anyone on the field. They might have someone in Nairobi covering a story in the DRC. So there's a lack of resources, human resources, and a lack of infrastructure as well. What's available for journalists to actually cover these stories properly? And that's why you see Africa being portrayed as a country. It's easy. If you can't find the place, just say, oh, like the world, when the Africa Cup was going on, a lot of people couldn't say in the media whether it was in Equatorial Guinea or it was in Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry. They didn't know where it was. So it was easy to just say, oh, Africa Cup of Nations happening somewhere in Africa. But being from an African background, of course, at SBS, we knew where it's coming from, but very often in the sports reports, in the other media, you would find just Africa Cup of Nations and no more information about the country where this is happening. And this is just because of maybe the junior journalists who are covering it are not quite sure of where it is, and they'd rather say Africa because it's easier. They won't get it wrong. So I think it's a lack of infrastructure and knowledge as well.
But how much of that onus is on journalists? I mean, you know, we've sort of all worked in newsrooms and kind of know how it works. How much is it a responsibility for a journalist to really try and tell the facts of a story, particularly when it comes to Africa reporting?
Well, the information is there, but another thing that, I can say is ignorance and laziness and lack of time, because the time you allocated to prepare a story is very limited, and the resources that you have, because everything is available there. At the time of this era of the World Wide Web, it's not believable that you could still refer to Africa as a country. It's a continent. As a country, it's a continent with 54 different countries and hundreds of nationalities and cultures and languages and a variety of experiences and other riches. It's only a lot of the time when something negative happens, something bad happens, of course, the reports will come out. But the other aspects of the African continent that's not covered properly is also the good stories coming out of Africa. And these stories are rarely ever covered, even here.
It's interesting that we were talking a bit about this beforehand. I mean, if you look at mainstream media, which is only one aspect of media when it comes to covering Africa, there is, if you look at, I'll give you the 7 p.m. news bulletin on the ABC. There's domestic, there's international, there's sport and weather. When you break it down, every story that is in the foreign section has to compete with each other. So we were talking, you know, this week you would have the Rohingya story close to home. You would have what's happening in Burundi. Bet you no one's seen anything about that. There's a lot of stories going on, but it's really hard to get them into a main bulletin. But they're there elsewhere. I don't know where I'm going with this, but it always comes down to it's the journalist's fault that the coverage isn't there. But it's kind of shoot the messenger stuff. A journalist can only tell so many stories. There's a lot of other things at play here. To give you an example, if I was sitting there in Nairobi or Johannesburg, where I was based, there's a big story happening in Congo. It could take me 2 months to get a visa. Whose fault's that? Is that mine? How am I going to cover it? How do I, get to it? Zimbabwe, I have covered that so many years, undercover, illegally is the only way to do it. Legally now, because I could and I should. I tried for 2 months every day. We made a phone call trying to get a visa. They didn't want us in there. So they will store you. I'm one person with one producer. How much time we spent just trying to get a visa to get into that country, I'm not filing another story. So you can blame journalists a lot of the time for stuff. Well, fine. But a lot of people have to step up in this mix as well to make it happen. Community groups here. Why aren't they knocking down the doors and saying, we're important, we matter. As a community, we want more about what's happening in our region. 70% of the Australian aid budget was cut. Where's the voice from the African diplomats who are here coming out and speaking to journalists and saying, do something about it? Why are they all quiet? Why are they saying nothing? You know, so there's many, many avenues about this, that there's no right or wrong. There's also, are you interested? Is the general public interested? Do they watch commercial news because they want to see the building that blows up? Because that's more interesting than finding out the latest development in Burundi. You know, they're questions. I mean, that I don't have the immediate answer, but there are many questions.
Well, you've just explained something that I've for a long time sort of wondered about. Because it's so difficult, you cut corners. Is that that's you've sort of confirmed that some people cut corners because it's too difficult.
In what regard?
In relation to, say, for example, if you're in Nairobi and there's a story happening in Congo or Harare, and because it's so difficult to get there, then what
you
is
you don't do it. You can't cover it. I mean, if I'm a television journalist filming it, if I can't get there, I can't film it. So it doesn't get covered.
Okay. So earlier there was a reference to laziness as a factor. One of the things, I mean, we'll come back to the issue about the Africans who are here in terms of stepping up and making their voice heard. But before we do that, I just want to go back to the quality of the reporting that we get here. You know, as a person from Africa, living in Australia, I very often when I look at a news report, I cringe. I literally, you know, can't stand to watch it because the quality of the reporting, because I know the continent, I know what the issues are, and if we take Burundi as an example of something that is just happened recently, very often what I would tend to do is to see the news report very quickly and get on the internet and actually try and get the facts, because what I see on the news, even when there's a reporter there on the ground, is absolutely awful in terms of the quality of the reporting. Now, my question to you, and we're very lucky, very fortunate here to have an African reporter who has reported from Africa, a non-African here, is that why is the quality of the reporting so bad?
Partly, I can try to answer that. Most of the time, the information that we get here, let's say we're talking about Burundi here, the reason why there's a... I'm trying to justify, because I go through it every day, covering events from Francophone Africa and English-speaking Africa. The problem we get is things get lost into translation. And another thing is there's very high quality journalism happening now in Africa, better than it used to be in the 80s and 70s. When the events were unfolding in Burundi, we could follow it as they were happening live, because some private Burundi radio stations were covering it live in Kirundi. You've got to be able to speak Kirundi to understand that. Fortunately, I can speak the language. But for a Western journalist covering it, they wouldn't access that information. And the other thing that's happening is there's a lack of proper coordination and cooperation between the local African media organizations and Western organizations. The local African journalist, whatever he produces, might not be picked up by the Western news organizations. Or if it's picked up, it's just a little fragment of it that's picked up. So the reporting on Africa will come from the BBC, Reuters, AFP, which is Agence France-Presse, and all these big media organizations, whereas those journalists working on the field who have local knowledge, their work is ignored or just left aside.
Is it possible, maybe, sorry, I may be speculating here, is it possible, because Africa is one part of the world where anyone can say anything about Africa and it doesn't matter. There are countries in the world where, and China is one example, where if something was reported about China, there would be a lot more reaction from the Chinese government, maybe the Chinese community, but Africa is one part of the world where people get away with almost saying anything about Africa. Is it that lack of accountability potentially a factor?
Well, it's hard to know. It's hard to respond because I'm not sure exactly what examples you're kind of referring to. I mean, coverage is bad is kind of...
Can I step in? When, Ginny, you made the example about working in Nairobi and having to travel to the Congo and, you know, the logistics of it all, one of the factors, I would assume, is resources. I mean, you're one person that is the Africa Corps, one person covering an entire continent. That on itself is a tough ask. So do you think there is, you know, a need for media organisations to invest in, you know, how we report on Africa? You know, do we need more journalists that are, you know, specialised in that area? We do have with Asia. You know, there tends to be a focus because, I mean, politically, that's where the focus is in terms of foreign policy. But do you think perhaps that's what we should be looking at?
Yes and no. If you had the money, if the media organisations had the money, absolutely. But everyone is shrinking. When I was there, the newspaper headline that came with me being appointed was sole correspondent from Australia to be based as a foreign correspondent covering Africa. The only person from any Australian news outlet to be based in Africa. One. Just one. How do you expand one? You're not going to suddenly... If you want to suddenly... You know, the ABC is too small for this in that regard. Their foreign bureaus are actually shrinking to hubs. You know, the BBC has a model where they have, you know, 50, 60 people in a country who are working for local-based, whatever. One person, if you had to try and wrangle journalists from around the continent to try to get... It just can't happen. I mean, one person can't do it, let alone try to wrangle content, telecommunications. It doesn't work. It can't work for... You know, it'd be great if it did, but it couldn't. Not for the ABC, at least. Mm. It's just not a model. You know, yes, you could say local journalists should have more content, but how do you make that happen? It's not an easy... How do you get a journalist in Zimbabwe to be reporting on news in Australia technologically, time zone-wise? How do you cross-check what's going on? It's just a really complex matter to go that route. Mm.
So just going back to the descriptions and the language, what sort of impact do you think, you know, the stereotypes in terms of reporting has on the African-Australian community here in particular?
Very negative impact. Because when you meet the public, they say, why is it that the positive stories are never told? Well, the negative stories have to be told. They're there. But the positives never get told. Or the stereotypes are often reinforced. And when we report about some countries, there are mantras and little jingoistic descriptions that keep propping up. Let's say Somalia, Al-Shabaab, Somalia, terrorism, Rwanda, genocide, Congo, conflict, and things like that that keep propping up.
But aren't they a reality?
They are a reality, but there's a danger of always describing a country according to just one little story or one event. Rwanda in itself is bigger than just the genocide that happened. It's a tragic event. It's really something that everyone must think about, but it's more than the genocide. But wherever a news item comes about Rwanda, you'll see, oh, this is happening. It's a country, a success story, and Rwanda went through a genocide in 1994 in which this many people died and this. That's true. But is that the only story? And there are other stories about Rwanda, the survival skills, the resilience and all that, and the people struggling to make it in life, or even other success stories happening there. But this jingle about the genocide keeps coming up. And when I meet someone in the street, are you from Rwanda? Yes. Oh, that's where there was a famine 20 years ago, or there was a genocide, or there was war, without even knowing where Rwanda is. And sometimes I'm asked, where are you from? I'm from Africa. Somewhere in Central Africa. Is it near Zimbabwe? Oh, I said, no, it's Central Africa. So there's a lack of knowledge. And when the reporting comes with all these little jingoistic things, it just reinforces it in the minds of the people. Even if I don't even say I'm from Rwanda or Burundi or anywhere, If I say, oh, I'm from Congo, ah, there was famine. There was never famine recently. It was maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. There's no famine in recent history of the Congo. But that's what the people know, because in the media, that keeps coming up, those little jingles, and those descriptors of these countries keep being even attached to other countries that haven't gone through these negative events.
Stanley?
Well, I was just about to say that you're right. I mean, the reporting of the Ebola crisis, I'm very critical about the reporting, I must admit, because it's something that I feel very strongly about. And another very good example was the reporting of the Ebola crisis. Here was a situation where something terrible was happening in Africa, and therefore it's fair for it to be reported, as you would say. But there were three countries in Africa that were affected by the crisis. Yet the impression that was being created was that there was an Ebola crisis in the entire continent of Africa. And I made a point of following most of the news report to try and get a sense of where they were coming from. And it did surprise me that that aspect was never really brought up in terms of where the crisis was was happening. That was one thing. And the other thing about that is that, going back to the impact on the community here, even the way people look at you here, I mean, we live here, so we do know, the way people relate to you or look at you, or the way that people talk about those issues after it's been reported in the news, of course it has an impact. It has a significant impact here. But going back to my earlier point, I don't actually mind people focusing on certain stories that may be viewed as being somewhat, you know, not being positive, so long as it's factual. And I think what we miss here is a lot of factual reporting. Again, I haven't worked in a newsroom. I only work for community radio. And so I don't know how it works there, but I can tell you that, you know, going back to the Ebola crisis, I did struggle to find a report that was factual. When you compare that to the BBC, there was a brilliant journalist that sadly died about 2 years ago, Komla Jumo, on the BBC. He was probably one of the sort of early examples of an African person who understood that challenge of really being able to give to the world an understanding of what's going on beyond just very quickly putting together something that, doesn't actually help people understand what's going on, but almost like just a newsflash.
To give you mentioned the Ebola crisis, and I don't know if you remember the story, Bertrand, but we actually covered it when there was actually a community that was affected. The children were being bullied at school because of how Ebola was being covered in the media here in Australia. Mm. It was incredible. And again, it comes back to how do you, you know, the language, where does the onus fall? I can't speak for other broadcasts. I can speak for public broadcasts because that's where I work. And I tend to think there is some level of accountability when it comes to trying to tell the facts in the best way that we know how, given the limited resources. And I can't speak for anyone else, commercial broadcast, never worked there. But, you know, what's the onus for us who are there working in these systems? Where do we begin to, one, if it's with our colleagues, when it's with our editors and we're having these conversations, to ensure that at least we're trying to get some of these things right that Stanley rightly highlights?
Can I just say, I mean, I didn't cover the Ebola crisis, I was back here, but I was also very much aware of the coverage that Foreign Correspondent did in covering it. So they had a team on the ground that went in, they were the first that was actually in there, they reported it, they showed it from people on the ground discussing it, talking about it. So, you know, they did a really good job, and that story was taken off around the world because they got in there and showed it. Our ongoing coverage, well, we didn't get in. I mean, you know, after that, I was here, I had finished my posting. So, but, you know, it's difficult because, you know, a lot of the examples you're saying, you can be critical of the whole media. Well, I can't respond for the whole media. I mean, I know what the ABC did and I know how they covered it. And you can argue we should have done more, could have done more, but how much can you actually cover one story? That is the issue. The perceptions, well, again, if it's everyone thinking it's all over Africa, the best thing I saw was John Oliver on, I can't remember what his program is now called.
Tonight with John Oliver?
Yeah, something, This Day Tonight or whatever it is. But it was just brilliant because he summed it up perfectly when he had a South African comedian who's now joined the show saying, look, you know, I've come here and, you know, I'm worried. I'm here in America because you've got Ebola, we don't. You know, and that, you know, that is a misconception that in America they've actually understand a hell of a lot more about Africa than we do, about where countries are and what have you. But they get it wrong there because a lot of people just want to accept that it's Africa. They don't want to think any further. It's,
No, that's a point you made there. But there's another thing that happens with the Ebola crisis when we were covering it, trying to raise awareness. There were communities trying to steer the media to do something to steer the government because the Australian government took some decisions. For instance, the visa bans and suspension of some categories of visas to a whole bunch of African countries. This never made it into mainstream media. It was covered, but there was a lot of concern in the community. And another thing that, well, we didn't touch on when we were talking about descriptors, we don't describe the US as the country of slavery, the country where the slaves were taken. But in African countries, yep, terrorism, hunger, famine, and all that. But leaving that apart, another thing that I see happening in the media is when something is happening on the African continent, I'll come back to the Ebola crisis, is when the media goes to find specialists and people who are going to talk about these events. It's very rare that you get African specialists talking about these events. Not only the Ebola crisis, this happened. And another thing that happened recently is the Garissa crisis in Kenya at the campus. All the experts that we saw in counterterrorism were all from Western institutions and university lecturers and all that. But here in Australia, we have some Kenyans at Murdoch University who are experts in counterterrorism. Not a single media organization went to these experts. Or when things are happening, when we're trying to raise awareness about Ebola, we have Sierra Leonean doctors here. We've got Guinean doctors. We've got Liberian doctors who are here, who have contacts on the field, who speak the language. They hardly made it in the media, whether it's at SBS, ABC, or any other mainstream media. So there's always this tendency to call on West, we're talking about Australia here, we call upon Western experts and we don't rely on the African experts who might be around and who could give an expert knowledge of the situation. And this is a point that I would like to raise and say that maybe in the future we call upon these experts as well to have their input. Maybe then that's when Africa will be seen as a diverse space and not just one lump object where you can just put in everything that's not understandable or exotic. Mm.
So do you think, coming back to the responsibility that rests, some of the responsibility that rests with journalists and how we go about, you know, telling these stories. Yes, we do have limited time. Yes, we don't have enough resources. But an example that comes to my mind was in recent weeks here in Melbourne, we had a situation with a family in Wyndham Vale. It was South Sudanese and tragic incident where the mother drove the car into a river and three of the children unfortunately died. And it was the way that story was covered. There were lots of cultural sensitivities because it involved the South Sudanese community. And throughout, I think, the 4 days that story was being covered, the single story that kept coming out was Sudanese family, this happened. No one had actually thought to ask the question, which Sudanese community are you talking about? Is it the South Sudanese community? Is it the Sudanese community? And it wasn't until I called Victoria Police Media and said, do you mind, you know, clarifying what the situation is, that then that narrative started changing. So whenever anyone was doing a stand-up or a piece to camera and reporting on that incident, they then started saying South Sudanese community. So we're all, you know, being a journalist, like, where does that responsibility step in where you sort of go, hang on, let me ask these questions, let me see if I can get more facts about this.
Yeah, this story was broken by the Dinka broadcaster at SBS. he's the first one who reported on this story. But then again, because it's indigenous, and he did report it on SBS as well, but the other media never picked up on this story. He had the facts right at the beginning, but in Dinka. And then in English on SBS on World News, but it was never picked up by other media. They just reported according to their own perceptions.
Well, it's not necessarily their perceptions. I take it everyone's responsible in that regard. You took up the responsibility by correcting it. But, you correct what you know that needs to be corrected. Mm. If you don't know, it's hard to correct. But I take your point. Mm. I mean, but, you know, that is a valuable thing that came up, that you actually did correct it.
But should we take that as, you know, the end outcome? Should we just sort of say, well, if people just are ignorant in that area, then that's just how it is?
No, absolutely not. I mean, so you didn't, and it changed it. That is the responsibility of everyone, I think. Mm. I mean, if you know something is wrong, I would always correct it. I would do exactly what you did. Mm. But, I mean, it's kind of like if you don't know that there is a possible error in there, it's hard to correct it. If you'd be second-guessing everything. Yeah.
Well, we have to raise a question there. Is the story was broken by a journalist based in Australia, based in Melbourne, who speaks the language of the victims mm. of this family who is involved. And this story was broadcast also in English. Why didn't the other media, that's my question, why didn't the other media refer to SBS as the multicultural broadcaster who've got African programs who are specialised in this particular context? And this one is even more so specialised that it's his own community that's involved. So he knows more, but no, was sidestepped and ignored. Mm.
I think the story was more important than the role of the journalist, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
But what about in that same, if we take that story as an example, there was a situation where some media organisations went to an African community spokesperson, this was in one particular community, and they were going there for commentary. I mean, where do we draw the line? Like, where do we sort of say, hang on, that's... You have to go to the right person, you know, go to the South Sudanese community, get a spokesperson from there that can actually talk about what's going on. Where do we draw the line there?
It's again a lack of representation, because we have to realise that, okay, we've seen as one lump object thing that's the unknown. But another reason why, in my view, is that Africa is considered as... as seen as it is and portrayed as it is in the media, is because the African organization and African migration in Australia is very recent and it's very scattered. And it's very easy for organizations to come out and describe themselves as African, whereas it's maybe one Kenyan, one Sudanese, and one Egyptian, and African soccer club or African this, whereas it's only three individuals from three different countries. And they're not representative of the continent. But again, sometimes I used to tend to blame them and say, why do you take ownership of this name of Africa? Why is you not representative? But then you also look at how would they describe themselves differently. If they need funding, they have to describe themselves as bigger than what they really are. If they want to be relevant in the community, they have to have a descriptor that really appeals to a wider audience. So it's a kind of double-edged sword there. And then the organisations that we deal with, maybe you've been here longer.
No, I agree with what you're saying, Bertrand. I think the reality is that we can sit here and hope that many reporters will do the right thing and report it in the way it should be. That's not going to happen. I think my view is that, I shouldn't say it's not going to happen. I think it will happen when there's a sense of accountability, when people make them accountable for what they're reporting. And that will only occur when we own the story as Africans here, when we can say that's not good enough. It has been really fascinating following what's happening with the Mount Druitt story, the struggle street. I know SBS is involved, so I need to be very careful what I say here. There's SBS people here. But I think this is a good example where the community is saying, hang on, this is not good. And I think that's what needs to happen. Now, regardless of whether the actual documentary itself was factual or was, obviously they made choices, they made decisions about what to show and what not to show and the way they went about it. But here you have an example where the communities come out and said, we're not happy with this, and they actively went out against it. And I think the same thing needs to happen with the African community here. And again, we, you know, as you said, it's a lot more difficult because it's relatively new and we are scattered, 54 different countries, speaking different languages, even though we all try and speak English here when we come here. We come from very different backgrounds. But I think the time will come when we get to the position where we can actually say, this is not good enough. And I think that's when things will change.
And I think that's really needed at every which level. And it's not just the community. It's your country's ambassadors. It's communities. It's organisations. It's the whole lot that needs to stand up and speak up. It's also very difficult for many people who have come here, who perhaps come from countries where there isn't a great willingness to embrace the media, except perhaps to shut it down, as in many countries. So that is a challenge. But just like you were giving the example of correcting South Sudan, people need to speak up and be involved and be engaged in it. The worst is to sit back, be silent and complain and do nothing.
You talked about before about the community groups not being up in outrage that the last week's budget, 70% of aid to Africa was cut off. And you talked about, you know, if the community had come forward, where's the outrage? And would that change the way stories were told? Do you think that the media would then open up to telling more African stories if the African community decided to unite and you know, bang loudly, you know, protest through the city? I mean, what do they need to do in order for their stories to be told?
Well, how is it that we're interested? As journalists, we're meant to reflect people's interests. If we think people are interested in a certain thing, we will, you know, obviously move towards it. I mean, media changes over time. I mean, the Asian coverage was not great for a long time and it's picked up. You know, it's about migration, about catering like SBS is meant to for the communities. That changes when people start wanting to be involved, to be heard, and to be, you know, engaged. It's economics, it's migration, it's engagement. Being in the media, being journalists in the media, that changes things. But it does, you know, that stuff takes time, but that's how it does change.
Would you agree, Bertrand?
I agree partially. And on the other side, you have to see that, okay, the Africans have to step up and actually speak for themselves. But it's an emerging community, and I think in a certain way there has to be some form of affirmative action, because when I look at it, the stories are told by non-Africans. And, okay, I came here already from another background, already trained and with a certain baggage, but I see here young African Australians who were born here, raised here, studied here, have graduated in journalism and other communication-related subjects. And they've been here maybe 10, 20 years. They've graduated and they finished their studies. I hardly see any in the media.
The media is a shrinking entity, my friend.
It's a shrinking entity, but see, I hardly see any to be there to tell these stories as well. They're not around. Why? What's happening there? Is it that they're not good? I'm not good enough because when I came, I didn't have English skills, so I can say that, okay, I disqualify myself for that. But the young ones who are born here and studied here, where are they?
But do African stories have to be told by Africans?
They have to be around, because if they're not told by Africans, who else is going to speak positively for Africa? Because we can say anything. Because I encourage Africans to go in the media, go in politics, whether it's with Labour, Greens, whatever, and be there and be advocates for Africans, for other Africans. So we need to see that happen as well. And that's when you can see voices being raised that the budget for supporting African countries is being, you know, reduced by this high percentage. It has to come from Africans, whether in the media, in the community, in politics, in all aspects, in all walks of life. It's not just organized structures that can speak for other Africans. It's also in all other walks of life, we need to have voices in there to speak for Africans.
Stanley?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I wouldn't agree with the view that only Africans are capable of telling an African story in a positive way. I wouldn't agree with that view. But I would go as far as saying that as Africans, naturally, some of us at least, would view Africa as a priority. We make it a priority. So it's a case of just acknowledging that it's more likely that an African person would see it as a priority and work at it a lot harder than somebody else. That maybe that is the difference. Going back to what you said about journalists and Africans who are born here and the level of interest in relation to Africa, I would tend to disagree because I think there's a lot of very active young people and they may not be, you know, making a lot of noise, but even if all you do is write a letter to the editor, I mean, that is a very important step to take. If you see something in the media, if all you do is write a piece on Facebook, even that is a very significant step. And a lot of that is happening as we speak. Compared to other countries where there's been African migration, particularly some of the European countries, what has tended to happen is because some of the early migrants went there to seek a better life, and so the tendency was to just really forget about Africa and just try and integrate. And I think we're seeing a fair bit of that here, in that the priority for many who come here is to try and make it work for themselves here and not worry too much about all those issues. But I think over time what you see is a new generation of people that actually take it upon themselves to try and make a difference. And I think in time we'll see that here as well. That's just my
idea. No, that's true. I do agree a lot with what you said. But the reason why I say Africans have to be there is because the narrative is so strong. Mm. So we need to have Africans to be there to sometimes, like, as you can correct what has been said, you can say, oh, listen, maybe you should moderate that language that you've used there, or maybe what you said has to be correct in this way or that way. So the Africans who are actually, who know that reality can really better speak about that. Mm. And another thing is what I see, what you see a lot of them active on social media and all that. What I see on the other side is what they react to. When we post stories online, on Facebook, and you see which stories get the more clicks, sometimes stories that are really very politically oriented will not get any clicks. I know that they read them, they listen to them, but they don't like them. And you put a very light story about
cats,
fashion, cats and all that, and all of a sudden it goes viral. And yet, I remember the reason why I'm saying this is because once I did two stories in one, not me, I did a story, a very light story, but very nice, positive and appealing to a great audience. That week we got thousands of clicks for that particular story. It's about a young Australian, African-Australian lady making it into Miss World Australia. And the same week, we had a story about a researcher at the University of Adelaide commenting about the future of ethnic media in Australia, how it was threatened by the budget cuts and all that. That story got about 20 or 30 clicks. And the other story that's, okay, it's nice to have someone, an African-Australian, Miss Australia, that would be good, but that story that was really important to cater for the whole community hardly got any traction.
Mind you, there's always a question as to whether the number of clicks is an indication.
We keep talking for hours. At this stage, I'll open up to the audience to take a few questions.
Just to make the point that Africa is the same size as Australia, USA, India, and China. There were articles in The Age and The Guardian which said, do we want economic policies like Africa? Do we want politics like Africa? So I wrote a letter to the editor complaining about ignorance, but saying that they can get away with this ignorance because of racism. Mm. And none of you have mentioned racism, Australian racism. Is that... or are you just being polite?
Are we being polite?
Well, ignorance is bad. Racism is there. I mean, you know, certainly there was the White Australia policy here, and to a certain degree, some would argue that there's been some changes, but there's still a bit of that. So, no, I think you're right. I don't think we underestimate or we overlook that. I think it's a fact. The fact that we haven't mentioned it is probably just a case that maybe the discussion hasn't got to that point. But I think racism is definitely a factor. But I would argue that ignorance is a more significant factor. Mind you, those two are related. Racism and ignorance are very much related anyway. And very often, sometimes I don't know which is which myself because they're so intricately linked. But you're right. I mean, racism is definitely a factor.
Yeah, and I'd have to agree with that too, particularly about racism and ignorance being interlinked. Because if it suits, you know, you're interested in what you want to be interested in. You're not interested in what you're not interested in. And that is a conscious decision. So that is, you know, it's the quiet hurdle that is, it's the unspoken elephant in the room. So that is always there. It's possibly not said, but there is definitely an element of that.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I just wanted to comment with regards to the idea of all Africans stepping up and getting involved. And thinking about that, I wonder about your optimism about that, because you are going back to that, the original idea that Africa is looked at as a country. Africa is a continent with 54 countries, and each of those countries have got very individual people with very different ideas, very different agendas, and not necessarily able to come together as one, just as if you look at Asia with all the different people, all have different agendas, different ideas. Even here in Australia, the same could be said for Europe. So I wonder if you'll ever see that situation where you've got all 54 groups looking at themselves as one and having the same agenda.
I could actually add to that. The example I can give is the Burkinabe community, the people from Burkina Faso. I was doing a story on them a while ago, and there's, according to the last census, there's only 28 of them in all of Australia. And you could argue that they could lobby, go to Parliament House, but it's 28 people. Given the numbers in terms of migration, I think there is some power in coming together as a united community simply because of the representation of some of the countries. But that's just my two cents.
Yeah, well, the representation is not... The numbers do not always tell the truth, because you can see some smaller communities that are really militant and they're really strong and they really work hard to get their voices heard. And in that particular instance, I can talk about the Rwandan community in New South Wales. There's only 200 of Rwandans in New South Wales, but when they organize events, they attract a huge crowd of more than 600 people, and they get all the authorities around because they're structured, they're vocal, and they know they work for a common purpose. And other communities that are much bigger, I've been to Ghanaian events or even other community events, and you see smaller groups. So the numbers are not quite indicative of the strength of the... It's just about being united and having the same message and having the same goal. So...
I was just about to say, I mean, I tend to agree with what you've just said. I think, in fact, that's is one of the challenges that we face, is that, 54 countries, how do you bring them together? But I do have faith that because we all face the same issues, we all face the same difficulties, there's an incentive there to come together. And I think that so long as we start talking and thinking that way, I think we'll get there. I'm also very, very uncomfortable with the whole Africa is not a country slogan. I'm a Pan-Africanist. I believe in the unity of Africa in time as an important goal. And therefore, whilst I do not see Africa as a country, I do see a united Africa as a goal, as an important goal for Africa, for African people in Africa and the diaspora. And I think there is a narrative there that certainly when I'm speaking to people in Africa, young people particularly, do have that awareness and that desire to come together. And I think when events, particularly what happened in South Africa recently with the, you know, xenophobia and so on, it causes people to think and say, hang on, what is going on here? Why is it that anyone from anywhere in the world could come to South Africa and more or less be welcomed, but a black African person is not welcomed in South Africa? So those issues are causing people to think very carefully about, you know, how we see ourselves as a people. And coming back to those who live here, I think the fact that we're all facing the same difficulties, the same challenges, provides an opportunity to hopefully get together. And I see examples of that in various places.
Any other questions?
Thank you. So this is a question, I guess, generally to the panel, but it was sparked by... Sorry, I didn't catch your name, the woman in the middle.
Ginny.
My name's Soretti. So my question, kind of from some of the comments that you made, I've kind of pieced together that representation and discourse are not necessarily as important to you as just the fact that the story is delivered. Some of the comments being like, you know, isn't that the reality when speaking about... the fact that, you know, war and famine and all these things kind of dominate the discourse in media in Africa. So my question to the panel is... sorry, I've lost my question. If non-African journalists are not willing or ready to appreciate discourse and representation as something as important as the delivery of just, you know, the journalism, should we and can we be critically reassessing the role of non-African journalists in the forefront of reporting on African issues? And if that's the case, how do we go about doing that?
Wow, you're the non-African.
That's a tough one.
Well, non-African journalists have the right to exist. They do have the right to exist, and God bless them. Some of them are good, like our very good friend over here. They're good, very good people, and they try their very best. No, I look, all we're saying here is that we have observed that the quality of the reporting when it comes to Africa, you know, I mean, you could argue about, you know, what's the best word to describe it. Personally, I think it's very, very poor. And so we're trying to find ways to improve that. Now, it seems to me that if there's a lot more noise, a lot more accountability, then that will put pressure on anyone, whether it's an African person or non-African person, to do better. And I think that's what we should be focusing on. Clearly, by having more African journalists reporting, we hope that that would, in some ways, create a bit more pressure and more competition for the non-African journalists, hopefully. But I think they would bring something that we maybe haven't seen yet, you know, a different perspective maybe, and that might lift the game a little bit. And I think that's what we're trying to say here, but we're not suggesting that there is no place for non-African journalists. I think that would be the wrong, completely wrong message.
Well, I was one, so feel free to knock me off. But you're forgetting the big thing here is that, you know, you're looking here. What about the international media? I mean, that is there. Al Jazeera is doing a fabulous job terms of its coverage of Africa. Most of its journalists are Africans about Africa. So you can, I'm not, you know, I'm a little bit perplexed in describing all coverage as poor, because we sit here in Australia with access to Al Jazeera. It's on ABC. It's on SBS. So, you know, I was one, and you can say poor. And I don't take it personally. I don't. But you can say that lack of coverage, yes, is poor. But, you know, if you're talking about SBS and ABC, we're just not giving it perhaps as much as you would like to see. Al Jazeera gives it wall to wall. I mean, you know, BBC has African programs. Again, depends what you're looking at. What you're saying is poor. 7, 9 and 10, well, unless it explodes, goes bang, has a fire, no international news gets covered. So really, I mean, you've got to look at things in perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we probably have time for just one more question.
Thank you for the presentation. The aspect I want to sort of look at a little bit is beyond the media. I mean, I tend to work outside of that. So the issue for me, having spent some time in Ethiopia many years ago, is the perspective of the culture and the history of the African peoples and where that information and knowledge really is compared to, say, European history background. For example, where can I go and study ancient Ethiopian history or medieval Ethiopian history? No one here has mentioned, you know, Greater Zimbabwe. We've had civilizations in Africa like in Timbuktu, Songhai. You could argue that the Moors in Spain, in Andalusia, that was really an African civilization, because where did the Moors come from? If one of my favorite authors, Albert Camus, he's labeled as a French author, but he was born in Oran, in Algeria. One can go on and on. So it's also this perspective. The way these news items are shaped is also a fact of the lack of cultural awareness of a lot of the journalists. And sometimes you may even get African journalists who may not be aware of the history of the continent itself. So anyway, over to you, because I could keep going on with this.
How important is that cultural awareness when it comes to reporting?
And that,
well, Dateline covered the whole issue with Timbuktu, so did Foreign Correspondent. I'm very well aware of it. It's a news event. I mean, you know, great civilizations time past are not news. I mean, quite simply, it's a historical program or it's something else, but it's happened. I mean, I'm being very glib. I'm sorry about that. But what I actually mean is news. I mean, cultural events become something else. It's not a news story unless something happens. Palmyra, what's going on with ISIS? Potentially, yes, it is a great news story of significance, but in itself it's not a news story. So the history, the cultural aspects in a two-minute news story, which is very long for most news bulletins, it just isn't going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, but that comes back to what I said a little bit earlier about knowledge about other countries. What we know about what a Rwandan or a Ugandan or a Zimbabwean would know about Ethiopia is what they read in Western books. So we rely on Western media, on Western publishing houses, on Western publications. We hardly have any. It's only now that is starting, when you have online African publications being available to other Africans. It's just a recent phenomenon, and it's picking up at a very high pace. But before that, you had to rely. When I went to study, we used to study French history, and we, learning French, would describe our ancestors, the Gallic people, the French people. And that's how we learned French. But my ancestors are not French, because the textbooks that were available to us were brought to us from France and Belgium and all that. And then, so there's that lack of information generally. And that's why when we're talking about Ethiopia or anywhere else, the information doesn't come through, because there's a certain market for that information. It's available, but it's not available to the journalist who is... It's available to them, but they don't have the time to do it in a news piece. They don't have the resources also to... I mean, the time restraint to cover these events is not there. Because they're given an hour to produce a news item and...
That's a minute and a half long.
Yeah. Right on that note... we've come to the end of tonight's event. Thank you all for coming. If you could just join me in thanking Stanley Goma, Ginny Stein and Bertrand Tindangame.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.